amend the prayer and the application for writ of error granted. Call now the case of Trahan against Trahan. Counsel, please come to counsel, please. Counsel, it wouldn't take you very long to do that, would it?
It certainly won't.
All right.
What, 10 days?
I wouldn't think it'd take you that long.
I am will take no longer than how long you would.
Well, a week.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been mean. take you a week to amend your prayer, I'll be surprised. A week, counsel. Call now Trahan against Trahan.
May it please the court. This case is a domestic law case, too, as you're aware. It originated as a petition action. It involves the military retirement issue, and that's the sole point upon which you granted the writ of error. The original divorce, because the party remarried and re-divorced. The original divorce, though, from which the military retirement question sprang, occurred in 1963. The husband retired as commissioned officer in the Air Force in 1965. The party remarried briefly in 1970 and were re-divorced in the spring of 1971. The suit for petition was filed in 1977 following this court's retroactive application of theory in the Taggart case. I am happy at this point to be able to say that I was sort of an old hardhead and had fortunately read one or two of the law review articles, including a comment in the St. Mary's Law Journal on theory versus theory, which I thought raised very substantial federal question considerations on the proposition of the divisibility of military retirement. For that reason, I raised the point in the trial pleading that was presented to the trial court. It was tried in the fall before Izquierdo was decided in January. And then, of course, on appeal, I urged that Izquierdo had decided the issue in our favor. I could understand the trial court and the Court of Civil Appeals' reluctance to go against theory in the line of cases out of this court. And I thought that the final resolution of the issue would either occur in this court or in the United States Supreme Court. This court is quite obviously well aware of this issue and has considerable familiarity with it. I think it is very clear from reading the opinion in Ex Parte Burson, and in particular footnote 2 to that opinion, that this court, and I think this is very understandable, put out a caution to the bar that this court probably was not going to disrupt its federal law if the Izquierdo, in fact, was distinguishable on the basis of Section 231M of the Railroad Retirement Act. I think that that footnote also is a clear warning to all careful readers that Izquierdo might very well be distinguishable, because the court went out of its way to cite all the various cases pending on application for writ of certiorari in the Supreme Court. Went out of its way to say that this court found no express preemption, that there was no express preemption, and that you found no implied preemption. And thus, retirement plans, unless federally preempted, are community property. You also cited Professor Reppy's article in the Community Property Journal, learning to live with Vicierto, which I cited in my application for the bill, because one of his conclusions in that article was that the prospects look pretty bleak for the future of community property treatment military retirement benefits. It's also very clear, I think, from the Burson opinion, the Perez, Ex parte Johnson, Eichelberg, and various other opinions of this court on other matters, that this court will not hesitate to follow the federal Supreme Court's determination of the law. I have studied McCarty with some care. I had the brief that was submitted in the Supreme Court of the United States. I have wrestled considerably with how McCarty might be distinguished, because I full well recognize that it turns the community property system, as it has now been established in this state for several years, completely topsy-turvy insofar as treatment of military retirement benefits are concerned. I have not been able to come up with anything that would distinguish McCarty from this case, and therefore I think that it is a controlling authority. The officer involved in the McCarty case was retired Army, whereas the officer involved in this case is retired Air Force. However, the Supreme Court says in McCarty, it seems to go to considerable extent to try to settle these issues, that the retirement system of the branches of the military are substantially similar. And in fact, if you compare 10 U.S.C. Section 3911 and the statute following, which is the Army Retirement Statute, with 10 U.S.C. 8911 and the statute following it, which is the Air Force Retirement, you will find, and they're in separate volumes of U.S.C. 80, so you can't actually lay them side by side, which I've done, you will find that the headings on the indexes are the same. The only difference is the digit. One of them is 39 and one of them is 89. If you change the first digit in the number, the indexes could be flip-flop. The statutes themselves are substantially the same also, with the changes necessary to make one applicable to the Air Force and one applicable to the Army. Also, in the Burson opinion, this court pointed out that one of the cases pending on application for writ of error was Miller v. Miller, a Montana case signed by Montana Supreme Court in 1980. The Supreme Court of the United States, in the McCarty opinion, commented specifically on the Miller case. That was a divorce action in which not only had the a share of the, I think it was 35% of the husband's retirement been set aside to the wife, but the court had also put in its judgment that if she predeceased her husband, her interest in the his retirement passed to her heirs. They commented on that and said that at least one court, parentheses, on non-community property state, quote parentheses, has gone so far as to hold that the heirs of the ex-spouse may even inherit her interest in military retired state. See N. Ray Miller, third pending sub 9 Miller v. Miller, number 8291. Clearly, quote, the law of the state is not competent to do this, close quote, McLean v. Essie and the citation, which kind of tells you what they're going to do with that case on the application for the first URI, which in fact they did in the lawyer's edition, 69 lawyer's edition, segments on the entries on page 1000. They vacated the judgment of the granted writ of certiorari, vacated the judgment of the Supreme Court of Montana, and remanded it for further consideration in light of McCarty versus McCarty. I point that out because that Montana case, the Miller case, is an Air Force retirement case rather than Army. return. I'm gonna not say too much more and maybe try to field some questions and explore whatever the court wants to say. I know one thing that my opposing counsel, Mr. Friday, wants to go into some extent. While it is not in this case, it's certainly something that you're going to have to decide, and you may want to decide in this case, and that is whether how the McCarty case will be applied, whether prospectively or retroactively. He has filed a supplemental brief, which he filed yesterday, I think. I read it last night. I agree with a great deal of what it says, and yet I don't agree that we ought to be cut off on the thing. He says that prospective application ought to start from the date of the McCarty opinion. I think that's clearly improper because it ignores the rule that changing the law while the case is on appeal means that the new law, if you consider it new law, has got to be applied to the disposition of that case. The other thing that I disagree with in his supplemental brief, he argues that under the case law of Fairley and Taggart and Busby, that this issue was a settled issue. I think that is clearly wrong. It's very much the same situation that we were in Texas prior to Fairley. I think most members of the bar considered that certainly non-vested military benefits, and perhaps even prior to Busby, vested military benefits, there was some question about, were not divisible by divorce court. It's only during the 70s that we've really gone into this area, and I asked a man that I have a great deal of respect for one time, I said, well, you know, is there anything to the argument that this was a settled issue in Texas prior to that time, that this was a change in the law? And the answer was, no, I don't think so, because you can't say that the law is settled until the Supreme Court has written definitively on it and settled. Then you've got a rule that you can say is a settled law, and if that's changed by overruling that opinion, then you can say that there was a change in the law. I think that we're in much the same position insofar as the federal issue is concerned here. The Supreme Court of the United States had not written a definitive opinion on the question of the division of military retirement in a community property state until the McCarty opinion. And also, this case, I'm happy to say, is not a case where I'm up here arguing about a final judgment or one where the point's been waived in the trial court. This case is here in the appellate process, and the point has been properly preserved all along. I want to comment on one case. This is getting a little bit of feel from the immediate thing, but it's something that I think that might be worth commenting on. I think the Burson case, the opinion in Burson, is absolutely right, simply on the proposition that if the federal law has given him the option of making the choice to opt out on military benefits and take the veterans benefits instead, and it's clear under the veterans benefit scheme that it's not divisible, that you can't say that state law precludes him from making that choice. I am a little bit disturbed by the opinion in Ex parte Johnson, and I suppose I am a little bit more disturbed by it because of what's said about it in the Burson opinion. In the opinion in Ex parte Johnson, we are not told whether that is a live case on appeal or not. In the Burson opinion, and we're not told when the divorce was granted. In the Burson opinion, we're told that the divorce in Johnson was granted in 1976, which is a pretty good while from 76 to 79 for the cases have been alive on appeal. And the reason that that is important to me, it seems to me that what Judge Pope pointed out in Burson, he said, if there is no appeal from the divorce court's division of the property, that decree may not have that comport with what I've always understood to be the rule concerning finality of judgment, is that if judgment as between the parties, even if it turned out later because of change of law or even heard your testimony showing up or something, if it was final judgment, it disposed of the issue. And that the certainty of having finality of judgment was more important than making sure you were absolutely right in a particular case that had already been decided, which I think is a good rule. The Johnson opinion is a little bit disturbing to me because I can't tell whether that is a collateral attack or not, and I'm disturbed by what I think is a very serious issue, and that is whether or not these orders, which have been issued in the last few years by the trial court, requiring the husband to divert a portion of his retired pay to the wife upon the receipt on penalty of contempt, is a void order. I would have thought it not to be a void order. And I would have thought that despite the expenses and realities of litigation, that nevertheless the rules of law would have required him to bring those cases forward through the appellate process, because certainly the courts were open to him, and the Supreme Court of the United States, for that matter, was open to him to see if he could get his case there instead of Colonel McCarty, and have that issue disposed of. That's something you're going to have to wrestle with. I am hopeful that you do not apply the McCarty case in such a way that it goes back and creates disruption. I agree with Mr. Friday's supplemental brief that the Taggart case, the retroactive application of that case, did create a lot of disruption. Had that case not been retroactively applied, we would not be here, for example, in this case. Our expatriate former justice of this court, who's now living down in Guyana, wrote the dissent in, I believe it was Taggart, and while some bad things might be said about him, he was not dumb. I think that dissent in Taggart points out some real problems with retroactive application.
And the counsel, with that evaluation for the dissent, I am free to reach my own conclusion about your evaluation about the majority.
Well, y'all are down in Guyana. I'm not talking about that.
No, but his dissent was not dumb.
No, it was not. I do not think the majority opinion was dumb either, but I think that it was. Well, it created a lot of problems, and if we apply McCarty retroactively, it's going to create a lot more. So I don't know. I thought the last case was awfully interesting, and there were several things that.
Counsel, did you ever hear of Epstein's law?
No, sir.
That law is that if you think the problem is bad now, just wait till we have problems.
Well, I was tempted. I found some solace in this. One of the things that somewhere in my past that I have read that made an impression on me is about the second or third sentence in Oliver Wendell Holmes' work, The Common Law. And I'm not sure I can paraphrase it exactly accurately, but I think this is pretty close. He says that the guiding star of the law is not logic, it's experience. And I think that that needs to be the guiding star. I think he's absolutely right.
I think
right,
we'll give him an NRE on that.
The life of the law is not logic, it is experience.
Yeah. There is one thing that, as long as I'm here, I'll comment on it. It goes back into the last case a little, but these cases obviously are related in this area. I am aware of Hicciardo and what it says about the consideration of military retirement in the division of the community of states. I think that that is a deep water issue, but for whatever value it is to the court, and I've wrestled with Hicciardo a long time, my view is that the Supreme Court of the United States would not hold that a Texas divorce court could not make an uneven distribution of community property after having set aside the military retirement as being beyond its reach. Now, there is one obvious distinction between the statutory schemes, and that is that in Hicciardo you do have, as you do under the veterans benefit statute, the anti-assignment and the anticipation of benefit provision. I don't think that's really the important distinction, however. I think the important distinction is that under California law, the parties are entitled to an equal division of the community of state, whereas under Texas law, historically, we have recognized that an unequal division of the community of state is appropriate when the needs of one of the parties require an unequal distribution. Obviously, I think and submit to this court that McCarty is controlling and that the case must be reversed on the military retirement benefit issue. I had thought, and I'm going to spend about 2 minutes, and then if you've got any questions or anything, I'd be happy to have them. Well, maybe I wouldn't either after him. But one of the points that the writ was not granted on, I'm going to comment on because I think that it merits comment, but I thought it was an awful good point. I thought it was a good point in the Court of Civil Appeals. And that's the statute of limitations point in this case. Judge Pope, in one of the opinions he wrote, and I don't remember whether it was Taggart or Shirley or which one of them he reported, but I know one of them alluded to the fact that you might have a statute of limitations defense in these partition actions. In our case, the evidence, in addition to the normal evidence that you have that one party got all the benefits and spent them, the evidence is that during the events leading up to the second divorce of these parties, that they had a pretty heated argument, and the husband told the wife that she wasn't going to get any part of his military retirement benefit. It's not denied that that discussion took place. It is argued instead that that discussion took place in the course of a very heated exchange between the parties, and that in some way apparently is supposed to do away with the efficacy of the question of repudiation of any interest that she might have or have had in the benefit. The Texarkana Court of Civil Appeals has held, as I read the opinion, that you've got to have virtually a formal rejection of some nature, whether in writing or whatnot, in order to reject a co-tenant claim. I think that while they don't recite the evidence in our case, and therefore you really can't say that it messes up the law all that much, and I don't guess it does, I think that that point might merit your consideration, and I offer it to you. And with that, I will sit down and let some of you have questions or comments you'd like to direct to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The arguments from the respondent.
The respondent is represented by Mr. Philip C. Friday.
And somewhere in your argument, counsel, you might address the limitation in Lash's point, please.
I'll do my best on that.
Even though it was, I understand, but was not granted on that point.
Well, may it please the court, it's a mark of the kind of lawyer that Sam McDaniel is that he would recognize, I think, the strong policy considerations in favor of some sort of prospective application of the McCarty decision. I don't particularly care to make a judicial admission that McCarty controls the framework decision, but at the same time, I can find no distinction between McCarty and outset facts. So you are brought to the consideration of whether to apply prospectively or retrospectively. Now, as I'm sure you know from dealing with this issue in prior cases, the United States Constitution does not require that it be one or the other. That's the so-called Sunburst Oil case. Historically, of course, the courts long indulged themselves in the Blackstonian fiction that the law was always there, but that the courts, in overruling a prior decision, were merely discovering or revealing the true rule. In modern times, I think halfway the courts have moved away from the fiction and have begun to use prospective application more and more for all of the practical reasons behind that. It's been the trend in Texas jurisprudence and the trend of this court to do so. The cases that I was able to discover that have been digested over the past decade in fields of torts and civil procedure and conflict of law, this court has uniformly made prospective application of its overruling decision. And I've cited about a half a dozen in my brief. Now, the United States Supreme Court, in the case of Stovall against Deno, has outlined what it thinks are the major considerations to be dealt with in determining whether to apply a new rule prospectively or retrospectively. And these are, first of all, the extent to which there has been some justifiable reliance upon the old rule, particularly where a contract or property rights are involved. Secondly, whether the purposes of the new rule can be effectuated without retrospective application. And thirdly, the extent to which retrospective application would create a burden on the administration of justice. The considerations, by the way, are said to bear equally in civil or criminal cases, and therefore we may look to decisions in either area for guidance. Now, in taking up the reliance issue as applied to this military retirement question, I think it's necessary to look briefly at what has been the effect of the Busby, Curley, and Tiger decisions. Since these decisions were handed down, there have been countless divorce cases involving these military retirement benefits. And in many of them, we can be sure that the benefits were taken into consideration by the trial court in trying to come up with a fair and just division of the property. Now, in my judgment, to give prospective application, or I said, I know that you're staggering as typographical error in my brief, to give retrospective application to the McCarty rule, I think may open the door to relitigation of a lot of these controversies. It has already been urged in this very case by an amicus curiae brief submitted by the firm of Washington Secret that in light of McCarty, this court should go back and void property settlement agreements entered into in reliance upon the Busby-Curley rule. And of course, as a matter of fact, we can be sure that many families have come to rely upon either the agreements that they struck off in their divorce cases or the decisions that were made dividing the property, using military retirement often as the centerpiece of those divisions. And there have been many important life decisions made by many different families in reliance upon these decisions. Now, this court has shown sensitivity to this reliance factor in other cases. In your Felderhoff decision involving the doctrine of parental immunity, you declined to give that retrospective application. You gave it prospective application only. And you specifically commented that many insurers and even tort victims, I was interested to note, may have relied upon the old rule in not investigating claims fully and not maintaining files and so forth. And of course, in your decisions on the rules of civil procedure, you have uniformly allowed the result reached upon the old rule to stand, even in the case of bar. Now, and I recognize that here your rulemaking power is also involved, and of course, Rule 814 specifically provides that all things properly done under any previously existing rule or statute prior to the taking effect of these rules shall be treated as valid.
Counsel, I really don't know where you're going. Now, you're making a good argument. Let me sure I understand. Are you suggesting that if the case was tried before McCarty, and this reaches us now, that we ought to say, well, it's very interesting that the Supreme Court of the United States has held this, but since this case was tried before it announced the rule of McCarty, we will simply ignore it?
Well, I'm not saying to ignore it, but I am contending very seriously that you're not obliged to apply it to the case of bar.
Well, that's pretty close to the definition of ignore, isn't it? I did not realize we had this problem when we came on the bench. It's been well presented. So I see them asking what you might call a dumb question.
Well, by no means. Let me deal with it. In your decisions in the tort field and the civil procedure field and the conflict of law field, what you all have had is a new rule which this court has developed, all right, and applied, forgive me just a moment. The situations have been that you all have fashioned a new rule, and you all have applied the new rule on your own authority. Our situation here is that, as far as the jurisprudence of the state of Texas is concerned, you stated very clearly that military retirement benefits are property subject to division. There's no doubt in our jurisprudence of that rule. Now, the United States Supreme Court has intervened, as of June 26th of this year, to declare a different rule, which I think now you all are obliged to adopt. But where the overruling decision has not come from this court and has come at a subsequent date in time, I don't think you're obliged to act as you do when you yourself develop the new rule and apply it looking backwards. Certainly, this has been your practice in the civil procedure area, although, as I say, I recognize that a lot of this is because of your own rulemaking decision that what's been done under the old rule is going to be allowed to stand. But there's some interesting comments in some cases in other states on this. There is a Kentucky Court of Appeals decision that I cited in my brief, which dealt with a case not quite on all fours. It was a conveyancing case, and it involved a family who claimed under a conveyance, gone onto the land, made improvements, been on it for some number of years. And after they'd gone on the land, made their improvements, there was a decision, not in this case, which altered that rule and gave another claimant under another chain of title the superior claim on the thing. And the Kentucky Court of Appeals came along and declined to apply that retroactively in the case of Bond. And its comment, I thought, was very telling. You'll forgive my fumbling for a second. It said, rights must not be gained or lost on the decisions of court, as money is won or lost in the rise and fall of the grain market. There's also a case out of the Supreme Court of California here in recent times, in which suit was brought under the old rule, and I'm not certain right off the bat whether this was, I think it was a tort principle. Suit was brought, and I guess the counsel thought it over a while and decided, no point in butting my head against the brick wall, and he non-suited it. And then in a subsequent and separate case, that precedent was overruled, and he came up with a new rule, which benefited this case and permitted. So he reinstated his suit and took it out. And here again, the Supreme Court of California said, no, we're sorry. We're not going to apply this decision made in a separate and subsequent case retroactively in this case. The other side was entitled to have tried out the case and to have had the benefit of the result, the benefit of your non-suit under the old rule.
I'm having a difficulty. Did we not say very plainly in Dr. Rees-Kierger that we are bound by decisions of the United States Supreme Court?
I'm not disputing that with you. But I think that you
all
are
bound
free.
Bound or not bound? This is my problem.
You're bound. The question is at what point in time?
The question is to have perhaps an argument that if the law has been changed, you're entitled to remand for a fair and just division of property under a lot of reasons. Quite frankly, I'm at a loss to say that we can just ignore the Supreme Court of the United States and McCarthy.
Well, the only thing I can say finally to that is that I'm not contending that you need ignore it. I'm just contending that you all have the freedom and the latitude to determine the date when you're going to apply it, including the date in which you're going to apply it to this case.
Would there be a difference, counsel, between the rule that this court might announce and the date of its application, prospectively or retrospectively, and one with the United States Supreme Court has handed down the supremacy clause, as you said, Michael Bunker? Would there be any difference in your mind in the two situations? Or do you think we could opt to apply only prospectively some decision in the Supreme Court?
Bottom line, I think that so long as the United States Supreme Court does not itself direct whether the rule is to be prospectively or retrospectively applied, I read the law as saying that you then can make that decision.
Would there be any problem about the United States decision affecting the contract, the pre-existing decision?
Well, now I believe there is some federal constitutional limitation on that. And I didn't brief that extensively, and I'm really not prepared to talk on that one too intelligently. But therein, the federal right of contract gets involved as well. Now, I can't argue that to you in this case. That's going to be, and some of them that may come up, if you all give retrospective application, that issue will come up.
Counselor, how do you see what the Supreme Court did in the Father versus Clark? Did they very merely announce what the Congressional Act said? Or do they make new law?
I think it's clearly an interpretation of the statute. I have to concede that.
Well, then, there's no new rule of law then, is there? They merely announced what the statute said.
To that one. I'm not quick enough to come up with it right now. It's very troublesome. I guess the best argument that can be said is that, once again, this is a matter of honoring the reliance placed upon the construction given by so many courts, and it's a matter of honoring the balancing consideration and the impact of, on the administration of justice of a rule which, in effect, overrules long line of decisions, that the latitude still exists to determine when to date the effectiveness of the decision.
How would you keep assuming now that this court would make the new rule as it applies to military retirement, equate that, if you would, with a change in a statute made by the legislature? That would have it to treat them equally?
Well, of course, I think that favors my position, because the rule declared by this court is that legislative change is presumed to be prospective, and that's the statute by its terms,
Says that if the statute is changed, then it affects all cases that have not been finally adjudicated. In other words, if you get caught in the middle of your appeal with the change in statute, would set you off and you get cut off. How would that, when you make the same application to a rule of law by the court?
Well, but it seems to me that the analogy there is to whether or not the United States Supreme Court tells us whether to apply their rule retrospectively or prospectively. I mean, if the statute tells us its impact, I think the legislature's will has to be honored. And likewise, if the Supreme Court has said we're going to apply this retrospectively or prospectively, then I think you all are bound to the time application. All right? But if it doesn't say, if there's nothing in the statute to tell that, then if I read your decision, and I cited what I hope to be one of your major decisions on the National Carloading versus Phoenix El Paso Express case. It's the law of this state that if it doesn't say so in express language, you next look to see whether there's some necessary implication. And if no necessary implication, the presumption is the statute runs forward in time.
Still got the question of any cases that are caught in the middle of an appeal and the state starts running since there's no final judgment.
Well, you know, I recognize that, and I've made the best pitch I can make on that. But I would like—I guess I do feel some conviction about this issue, just as
Clay tries
to join up, or to re-up, or to go ahead and get out. In all candor, McCarty does recognize a second purpose, which more or less boils down to just taking care of the retired serviceman. Now that purpose is served by retrospective application, I concede that. But the major purpose, it seems to me, they pointed to was this personnel management tool, or an incentive is what it boils down to. And you don't need to be retrospective to fulfill that purpose. Now, the third point, and on this point alone, if I were in your chairs, I would not apply this case retrospectively, I try not to be excessive in my choice of words, either in my brief or my argument, but I'm really predicting to you that you're going to get scores and scores and scores of lawsuits on this point if you make it retrospective. And I think it's going to be a very heavy burden. And, you know, Sam has already taken on one of the harder parts of my argument in commenting upon the impact of Tiger. And your decision there to make the Curley rule retroactive. I mean, you all have seen, as well as any of us have seen, what kind of a flood, or if not a flood, at least a pretty strong river that opened up. I mean, some of these cases went back and reopened, in effect reopened, settlements that were 20 years old. Of course, it wasn't technically a reopening because of the legal theory involved, which, you know, was that an asset not divided in the divorce was held in co-tenancy and could be later partitioned. But, you know, realistically, it was a reopening.
What about the limitation question? You going to talk on that?
I will hit it. Let me just say a few more words on the retroactivity, and I'll come to that. Now, I've been getting calls, and I know anybody that does any volume of family law has been getting a lot of calls since McCarty in several areas. It's either the serviceman says, let's get back in there and let's set aside that decree, or let's try to void our agreement, or the wife calls and said that so-and-so quit paying, I want you to haul him in for contempt, or the serviceman calls and he asks not only to set aside the decree, he says, while you're in there, let's go ahead and get back the $60,000 I paid the blankety-blank over the past 5 years. And I don't think that the doctrine of finality of judgments is going to be a barrier to that in light of what you all have said in Johnson and in Burson. I don't have the difficulty that Sam has with wondering whether or not those were final judgment cases. They're contempt cases. They're post-divorce remedies, and it's clear to me, I was going to say I bet my fee in this case, but it looks like my fee in this case is not going to be anything, so I don't want to say that. But I'm just certain that the records will support that those are final judgment cases. But because you all have construed the supremacy clause as barring enforcement of these orders to pay a share of the retirement benefits, in effect, those judgments have been successfully collaterally attacked. And they're no good. Now, to get out of that trap, you all either have to do one of two things. You either have to turn around and say, well, now, we're going to reconsider Burson and Johnson, or we're going to modify it, or you have got to limit the application of McCarty and Trahan prospectively. Because if you make it prospective, then the Burson-Johnson rule can't be strapped on it to kill all of these old judgments. I might say, by the way, that Sam argues that the date of the overruling decision is not really significant. The case of Linkletter against Walker in the United States Supreme Court, which gives the best history I could find of the whole prospective retrospective debate, says in spades that the date of the overruling decision is the key date as opposed to the date of trial or some other date. So I think we have clear authority on that. Well, all right, turning, by the way, you all did grant my cross point in addition to point number one on the McCarty issue. I'll go ahead and talk about the statute of limitations, and if there's any time left, I might take a lick on that, although I guess I'm feeling that's blowing dust in the wind right now. But with respect to the limitations, I wish I'd known that you were going to have some interest in this, even though the point wasn't granted, because I did not go back and review those sections of my brief. Basically, however, I take it that Sam is really conceding that the courts of civil appeals are pretty well established that before limitations will begin to run, there has to be a demand for the benefits and a repudiation. That's it. Well, he's not in his head. I mean, maybe he's not going to concede that, but it seems to me that that's pretty well established in our law. At least, I think that's established by the law of co-tenancy that's been developed in the real estate area over many years. Now, the real question comes down to what does it take to make a demand, and what does it take to constitute a demand of repudiation? The Texarkana Court in Trahan didn't run off in left field in overlooking this argument that Colonel and Miss Trahan had somewhere around their second divorce. There was another case, I believe it was out of San Antonio, it's in my brief anyway, in which, again, it was proven as a fact that the wife at one point had said, I don't want any of that military retirement. And that was recognized. I mean, it was proven up, and the court said, you know, that you can't take that kind of a comment to amount to a waiver of it, or really a repudiation. And there's still another case that's in my brief which has dealt with those kinds of arguments. There's a much stronger case in the brief in which there was actually a suit filed, and I'm embarrassed now not to have my details square on this, because there was either one filed and then non-suited, or there was a contempt action brought and then later the partition action brought. At any rate, whichever court of civil appeals had that one said, no, I said, even the fact that you went in here, I believe it was a contempt, even the fact that you've come over here with your contempt motion didn't really constitute a demand. You were mistaken in that the judgment really didn't give you a right to found your contempt on, but we're not going to call that a demand or call his spotting an answer to it a repudiation. So, as a matter of fact, I would go back to the considerations that have caused that rule to be built up among co-tenants, because it's simply, you know, co-tenants don't presume that if one of the co-tenants may be out there using the ranch or farming it, that because the other fellow is in town, maybe just sharing in the benefit of some tax write-off, that the guy who's out there using it is claiming hostily. I mean, that's never been part of it.
None of it's yours, well, that's repudiation, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, if he puts up a sign or writes him a letter and says, look, I'm tired of you.
If he writes him a letter, if he just tells him none of it's yours, wouldn't that be enough? I don't know. If it's troubling you that much, I'll withdraw the question.
No, I mean, how could I argue with that? If it's unequivocal. If it's unequivocal, I don't think whether it's in writing or whether it's oral.
You made the point a moment ago that one of these cases says you've got to have a specific letter of rejection.
That was Sam's argument about the specific letter of rejection. The language of this court, though, in co-tenancy cases has been that the demand and the repudiation must be unequivocal. That seems to be the talisman word in it. And my point in the Trahan situation, and in the little exchange that was proven up in the trial court, and obviously Judge Matthews' conclusion on the thing, was that there was no way it amounted to an unequivocal demand and repudiation. Now, also in my brief, and I should say my response to his application for writ of error, I've taken the position, frankly, that was a fact-finding, and that Judge Matthews made it, the Court of Civil Appeals reviewed it, and of course that's where it stops. But, you know, I can't argue against you that the court finds, as a fact, that there was an unequivocal repudiation, that doesn't count just because it was oral, just that there wasn't one in Trahan. Well, do you all have any other questions?
Campbell, just because we don't ask them doesn't mean we haven't got them.
Well, I might just say on my cross point, the Texarkana Court cleaned me out on that on the authority of ex parte Yates. What Judge Matthews did here was to order Colonel Trahan to pay not only a percentage of the future benefits to Ms. Trahan, but also said, and while you're at it, throw in another $275 so you can catch up your judgment for the arrearages here. And Sam argued that was garnishment, which I don't think can be sustained at all. The Texarkana Court didn't write on it at all. But they said, on the authority of ex parte Yates, this amounts to a debt. And you can't constitutionally order him to pay off the debt or hold this fellow in contempt for not paying the debt. But my position, it's not a debt. It would be a debt if he were ordered to pay it from unspecified funds. I concede that. But that's not the order. He was ordered to pay it out of these retirement benefits, which themselves, by the judgment of the court, were part of the community. All right? Now, for the 8-10 years before we got to trial, I mean, by the judgment of the court and by the rule in Tigard and Curley, they were co-tenants in it. But Colonel Trahan was putting her share in his pocket all of those years. Now, all Judge Matthews' order is saying is that which she should have had all of this time out of this fund, this same asset in which you are co-tenants, she's entitled to recoup at the rate of another $275 a month, that which she should have been receiving all of this time up until now. So I think it takes it out of the rule of ex parte Yates. I think it puts it into the rule of ex parte Preston and ex parte Anderson, and into the rule where you all have approved an order to pay over a particular fund that's in existence.
Thank you, Counselor. Rebuttal argument from petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Proceeding a little bit in inverse order, I don't think that you will find any case out of this court which holds that it is necessary to have a demand and a repudiation in order to constitute the notice necessary to start the running of statute of limitations in a co-tenancy case. And the reason, as I read the cases and the commentary, is that the courts require more in a co-tenancy case than in a normal case, is because in the co-tenancy case, obviously, either co-tenant has the right to the property and the use of the property. And therefore, there's nothing about use of the property or possession of the property that puts the other co-tenant on notice of a hostile claim. This is the typical rationale, as I understand it, behind the rules in the land cases. The problem with the argument concerning the finding of fact by the trial court, if it was one, is simply that it is contrary to the conclusive evidence. The evidence establishes as a matter of law that the statement was made that you're not getting any of my retirement benefits. It was, that's expellative deletion.
If McCarty applies to this case, we don't get to.
You don't need to get to that. That's correct. And the problem on McCarty, insofar as what opposing counsel is arguing, is simply that, as this court well knows, we take an oath as members of the bar, you take an oath on the bench, that we will uphold the law, the Constitution and the laws of the United States, as well as the laws of Texas. And this court is not the final court of review on a federal issue. And when we went into the trial court prior to the trial of this case, we invoked the federal law and presented to the court that the federal law prohibited the partition that was sought here. And we preserved that point all along. And I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that, I have no doubt that you have no doubt in your mind that you're bound to follow the federal law on the thing, and with the case pending on appeal and being a live case, the law is now defined by the Supreme Court of the United States is a controlling law on that point. The cases that Mr. Friday has argued, the one from Kentucky and the one from California or wherever, concerning conveyancing and tort law, those are normally matters where the highest court of the state would be the final authority, unless you run afoul of the federal constitution. And therefore, a change in the law might constitute something that would be a watershed event, which you could say that the rules are going to apply differently. But not where the federal question is involved here. Also, as a final comment, the argument that in some way you can apply McCarty prospectively and not apply it in this particular case, as the Chief Justice has pointed out, well, perhaps he hadn't pointed out, but I will say I have difficulty conceiving of that. In the normal case where you have a case decided which causes one of these changes in the law, there's no question that the case sub judice at that point was decided the other way. That's why you have the change in the law. I can't conceive and of this court coming out and saying that McCarty is now the controlling law, but we're going to apply it prospectively, and we don't have to apply it in this case. That argument just passes me by so far that I can't even respond to it. I don't have any further comments to make, except
what did Judge Matthews do with this retirement property? Did he split it?
Sir?
Charles Matthews, he the one tried to split
it? Yes.
What did he do with the military retirement?
He applied the formula that is typically used in these cases, which depends on the length of marriage as opposed to the length of the military service. And
did he split it?
Yes, in this case, it wasn't an even split. It came up with the former wife being set aside, I think it was 38.5%.
Which under McCarty now would be wrong?
Sir?
Which under McCarty now would be wrong?
That's correct. That's correct.
Well, if there's error in the case, and if there's any question of fair and just division, and there's a reversal, it may be that the trial court could have a new look at the rights of the parties.
I don't think you can, because the problem you get into there is this is not a divorce case. It's a petition action, and we're
You're
talking...
Right.
Sir?
You're right.
The divorce was in 63. In response to the question that Justice Spears posed to Mr. Friday, I have not briefed this out in depth. I have given it some thought and done a little work on it. I believe that the United States Supreme Court would apply the finality of judgment rule insofar as prior judgments are concerned if this court chooses to say that we're not going back into these divorces that have been granted in and petitions that have been granted in the last 10 years and have not been properly brought forward by appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral argument for both parties. That concludes the oral submissions for the morning. Marshal, return to court.
Are you please rise? Oh, yeah?
Absolutely silent as to the remaining overpayments. They say nothing about the overpayments.
I'm sorry, I can repeat that.
There are three notices of overpayment that were issued to Amoco, and Amoco was required to sign off on them before they could have the net overpayment returned to them. It was at that point that Amoco contacted the Comptroller's office and were assured that by taking a partial refund, or what Amoco needed is a partial refund, they in no way prejudiced their rights to contest the 62
petitions. Or contest it by administrative procedure, or contest it through court action.
Based on the record, they don't answer that question. It was that it would be without prejudice to their rights to contest.
Well, I think one of your arguments is that the notice, your motion for rehearing before the administrative agency was your protest. Is that correct?
No, it was not the motion for rehearing. It was the Amoco file prior to the petition for the hearing on the redetermination of the 62 liability. A detailed written memorandum stating specifically why they disagreed with the 62 deficiency assessment. And the reason I stayed away from that argument is that the Court of Civil Appeal didn't go with it. But I took a position that, all right, if we're going to say that you've got to come up under 105, there has to be an opportunity to pay under protest. And if the way the payment occurs is by some magnetic computer change that the comptroller does somewhere in his office, that the only way you can quote accompany the payment with a written protest quote is to have one on file at the time the comptroller makes his offset. Because obviously if you're not carrying a check or money up there, you cannot, in literal physical sense, accompany the payment with a written protest. We did have a detailed written memorandum on file at the time we took the offset. And when we initially started with this case in the trial court, I argued very strenuously, well, 105 should be construed to include this circumstance. Now, what the Court of Civil Appeals, as I read their opinion, said was, we're not going to reach that question. you. We're not going to file 105 in this case. What we're going to say is that you can't have judicial review of an action by the comptroller, which is outside the scope of this statutory authority. And I would submit that that is a correct decision. Now, when I started off, and there's another ground I talked about in the body of the appeals. The Court of Civil Appeals also cited a series of cases that have to do with the proposition that when an officer acts illegally or outside the scope of his authority, he is not acting for the state, and therefore a suit to correct
now,
that.
Now, if Bullock went back and reviewed all your taxes, that's your saying a word, and he says, Amoco, man, we owe you some money. Now, where is he acting illegally and outside the scope of his authority?
Because once he determined that there were overpayments in each of those tax years, then Amoco, and that determination was based upon the state fact Amoco made, he had made the determination that Amoco, through the state of fact, overpaid the account. And under 111...
But up to now, we're not illegal, are we?
No, we're not illegal. We're not arguing that we shouldn't have gotten money like that. But if at the point he determines there's been an overpayment, and then he credits it against the alleged deficiency, that he goes outside the scope of the statute, because the statute says the comptroller may, with the concerned taxpayer, credit. And again, I
think by the book, next time I just wouldn't say anything to Amoco.
Well, the thing is, next time, 111A has been amended, and he expressly has the authority to offset that. I would make the point that the legislature, at least presumably, doesn't do useful things when it amends the statute, and they thought they were trying to cover a hole in the statute when they amended one. There was a specific reason why the comptroller came back to the legislature and said, look, we need the power to offset these overpayments against deficiencies in other years. And our point is, they've got it now, but they did not have it then. And really, the result is not that Amoco somehow now gets the $718,000 and gets to keep it. What happens is we get the overpayments we made back. The 62 divisions is still there. We'll have to turn around and get it back to the comptroller, pay it under protest, and go back and find the litigation merits of this round. It's a secure trial to get there, but we ultimately, this thing should, I believe, wind up back on the merits. And the whole procedure, when you consider the length of time the state administrative hearing, and I'm sure that is certainly not all the comptroller. I'm sure that the Amoco helped stay up there for a while too. But nonetheless, it did. And the fact that what we're talking about is not the payment of the tax itself, really, or even the merits of the tax. It's the question of whether or not the comptroller can determine an overpayment in a given tax year. And under 111, as it was then written in 111A, credit the deficiency in another year without the consent of the taxpayer. And I submit that the record is very clear that Amoco did not consent.
Counsel, help me on this. This audit was made 9 years after some of these taxes were paid, and it was then determined that there had been a mistake. Is Article 111 just wide open? Let's say 20 years from now, somebody can say that some comptroller can come along and say, there's no protest before me, but I have $500,000 here. I'm going to give it back. My question really gets down to, does a comptroller have the power to pay back large sums of money for mistakes that were made a long time ago when the taxpayer has filed no protest and made no, taken no steps at all?
No, it does not, cause in 65 there's a 7-year statute of limitations placed on both elections and refunds. And the way Amoco was able to go back as far as it could, I forget the exact dates, but I think it was 65 to 72, you could go all the way back. But then after 1972, that was over. You were limited to 7 years. And so there is a procedure where you file for a refund, but you're limited to a 7-year period. You cannot go back 20 years or 25 years or whatever. You must stay within the 7 years it's set by, I think it's 1045.
You say that statute was enacted when?
1965.
It was not, it does not apply to these 62 and 63 taxes?
The way that statute reads, it says it was passed, and I don't have to quite get specific language in front of me, it says that you can have your refunds for all taxes paid prior to a date in 1972, as long as you get your claim in by then. After 1972, then the 7 years starts running against you and you're out of luck. Try to go back to that 7 years. Now, we've got a, I said there were two actions we wanted to review, and the other action is the denial of the refund. Because Amoco disagreed with the Comptroller's assessment and for 62. And Amoco concluded that Amoco really had overpaid by some approximately $109,000 in 1962 and filed a claim for refund of that amount. Now, going back to the language I've already read about there being a chosen action to recover taxes paid under the statute, and I think a chosen action is intangible property law, without question. The Comptroller denied that refund at the same time he refused to give Amoco the balance of approximately $295,000 balance still owing for his overpayments for other years.
So are you saying that on the chosen action theory that 105 will not bar it, that you don't have to pay it on the protest and invoke 105?
Well, I'm saying that a claim for refund situation, 105 does not apply. That's where you've already paid the taxes and come in and file for a claim for refund, and the Comptroller denies your claim for refund. And again,
well, you didn't pay on the original and the protest.
No,
but you still
not.
You're going to try to get them back.
I'm going to try to get them back.
And so thereby, you would obviate the 105 requirement of the protest.
Well, I'm not sure that I would use the word obviate. I think it simply doesn't apply. Because and 105 has to do with the situation when you come in and make the claim. I've run out of time. I may get just two more points.
Counsel, in your brief,
they are in my brief.
We'll review.
In fact, I do well to close.
Thank you, sir. And you may have heard us this morning when we told counsel we do read briefs, we do read records. Thank you. All right. Yep. Closing argument for petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, as to the contention that the controller can determine deficiencies or credits for only 1 year at a time, I don't see where that makes any sense at all. In fact, in plaintiff's exhibit number 4, you'll notice that the controller granted Amoco approximately $401,000 out of the $423,000 for the period May 1st, 1962 through April 30th, 1972. So apparently Amoco had no qualms about getting 10 years worth of taxes back at one time. Now I want to repeat again, the controller did not withhold anything. This case is just like Motorola's. They petitioned for refund of $97,000. The controller said, your refund is zero. Amoco lost its money because it did not sue within 90 days after having paid under protest. Amoco lost its money because it didn't protest in the first place, and then it never sought out legislative permission.
In 1962,
They didn't overpay. I mean, they underpaid, so they wouldn't have paid under protest.
Right, Your Honor.
When should they have protested?
Well, if they could have protested then, if they could have calculated themselves that they were overpaying the tax.
I'm talking about this deficiency that the comptroller found in 1972. He said, look, you didn't pay enough. Now, that's the first time that, maybe up to that time, well, they've underpaid it.
Right. In 1972, when the controller told Amoco, you have a deficiency of $295,000.
That's the first time they know about it.
Okay.
All right, now.
Go ahead, Your Honor.
They should have protested then.
They could have, and I've maintained this all along, they could have asked the controller for a check for $718,000 in exchange for one of $295,000 under protest. But they've never been able to explain why they didn't propose that. It was up to them to propose that.
Well, was that the first time that they should have protested that when the comptroller told you over this?
That's the first time that they could have, yes, sir.
And the thing that they didn't do, they said we don't owe it, we don't want a hearing, didn't they?
Right, they said we don't know it, we'd like to have a hearing with you. They got a hearing over there, and then they wanted to get into the court.
But where they didn't comply with 1.05 is, they didn't say, look, you give us a check for 700 or something, and we give you 200.
That's right.
Was an agreement made that we'll take this 493 without prejudice?
Your Honor, the only thing that Mr. Charles Nine from the Comptroller's Office told Amoco was that their acceptance of the $423,000 would not jeopardize their disagreement as to the owing of the $295,000 deficiency. There was, and that was only as to the administrative procedures at the Comptroller's Office. There was no way that Mr. Nye could guarantee Amoco compliance with Article 105. That is Amoco's obligation and responsibility, and there is nothing that the Comptroller could have done to say, we guarantee you're going to get this money back, or we guarantee that you're going to be able to contest this money all the way through the courthouse. That's just not within the Comptroller's right.
In what way has the state been prejudiced, or what is the substantive harm to anybody or difference in result that they didn't follow the procedure that you suggest? I mean, you're saying that if the state had issued a $700,000 check and they'd give them a three back, then Amoco would be in good position to contest this tax, at least have a forum.
That's right, Your
Honor. Now, that didn't happen. They netted it out. And just for general educational purposes, what difference does that make? I mean, is this a form over substance thing? Or?
Your Honor, it's a jurisdictional requirement of Article 105. Article 105 is a jurisdictional statute. Has been held so since the case of Rogers v. Daniel Oil Company that this court decided.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, what I guess I'm getting at is, why isn't there a compliance with it under these circumstances?
Because Amoco just never protested the $295,000 deficiency, which it had to do under 105, or it never sought other legislative permissions to the state. I'd like to inform the court, Amoco tries to get a lot of mileage out of the State versus Connecticut General Life Insurance Company case. It's very interesting that that opinion, written by Justice Stapley, starts out with the language, with legislative permission. Connecticut General Life Insurance Company instituted this suit to recover overpayments to the state of occupation taxes totaling $408,661.26 for the years 52 through 57 and for the year 1959. And this case was decided in 1964. I'd also like to clarify the point that the controller did not withhold any money. He did not net out money. Amoco lost it by not protesting it. That is simply what happened. I think Judge Greenhill made a very good point when he said that the controller, in effect, did Amoco a favor by refunding this $423,000. One important thing to remember is that the controller instituted this audit himself. Amoco did not petition for a refund. What if Amoco had petitioned for refund of $718,000 by its own act, and the controller said, okay, we'll look into it. The controller under Article 111 said, we've decided that your overpayment is not $718,000, it's $423,000. Amoco would be in the same position there as it is in this case.
if it had a chance to protest that $295,000, it should have. If it didn't, then it should have gotten legislative permission to sue the state. The denial of the $295,000 refund to Amoco is no different than the denial of the $97,000 refund to Motorola. In both cases, there is no vested property right that's been adversely affected. Mr. Davis twice in his oral argument stated, we've never reached the merits of this case. Well, if we've never reached the merits, how can there be anything that's vested? The two cases that he cited in support of the vested property rights argument are the Brazosport Savings and the Chemical Bank case. But those two cases involve banks for savings and loans that already had their bank charters, which were vested property rights and were being adversely affected. That's not the case here. Amoco doesn't have any vested rights. It has claims of overpayment, allegations about overpayment, and those could never be considered vested.
Counsel, I don't know enough of this area to ask this question, perhaps. I'm sure that the comptroller cannot audit every return every year as they're made. I'm still a little concerned about an audit that was made 9 years late or after the fact, and the power of Mr. Bullock as a comptroller to return money on which there had been no protest. I hear you say nothing about that, so I take it that that's no problem.
Your Honor, under Article 104.5, and especially under Article 104.5G, the controller cannot go back forever and refund any amount he feels like. Under the provisions of 104.5, taking these years as an example, the year 1962, which is that issue, Article 1.045 states that for the purposes of that statute, any taxes that were due, that were due and payable before the effective date of 1045, which was September 1, 1965, were going to be due and payable, considered due and payable under 1045 on September 1st, 1965. Article 1045G states the controller cannot refund any amount or issue any credit after the statute of limitations period for that particular tax has expired. The statute of limitations period for assessing the franchise tax is 7 years. So therefore, after September 1st, 1972, the controller is foreclosed under 1045G from refunding the BPI. That is the argument I made for the last part of my application.
But as I get it, under the statute, if the comptroller discovers a mistake, then he can refund without protest.
Yes, Your Honor, if he does it within that limitation period of 1045. That's correct. In the brief of Amoco, they state, provided Amoco to recover taxes paid under mistake of law was adversely affected by the action of the controller. The only thing I have to say in response to that was so was Mr. R.R. Robinson, and so was Dan Engel, Inc., and so was Harris Living Company, and so was Motorola, and just last month, so was Ms. Hansi Abbott. But the Court of Civil Appeals of the Austin Court and also the Waco Court have held that you have to come in under 105 if you want to contest taxes, and if you don't do so, you're just out. I want to make this one last point. I sincerely believe that 105 was applicable to the $295,000 petition, and that the $108,000, if it was not applicable, then what Amoco should have done was obtain legislative permission to sue the state. The choice is not between 105 and an inherent right of appeal of a vested property right. The choice is between 105, and if you can't come in under 105, legislative permission to sue the state. Under the guidelines that this court established in Cobbler and Harrington, this is clearly a suit against the state. And if you want to recover these taxes, you've got to have permission to sue the state. And if you don't have the permission, or try to get any other kind of permission, you're just out. Thank you.
What would happen if Amoco, at the special session of the legislature, or some other special session, or regular session, get permission?
Then, Your Honor, there's a
limitation problem?
I think we would be under 1045G. There'd be a conflict between how can this money now be paid if the period has expired. The legislature would have to make a decision whether it wants to appropriate these monies that AMCO paid long ago, and it has a squeeze and bite of the apple, so to speak, and let go. I haven't thought that much.